Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Naked Englishman podcast. I'm Richard Vobes, and this is the audio diary. It must be the 12th today. I think I said yesterday it was the 10th, but I do believe it is the 12th. I'm just going to double-check that, for it is Thursday today. I have somebody coming over later on today. There we go. At 4 o'clock this afternoon, so I'd better tidy up. The old house a little bit. I believe he's coming to record his own podcast at my house, wants to interview me. Not quite sure what about exactly. So I've been up since, 5-ish, I think. I sat outside for a little while on my windowsill outside the bathroom window this morning. And watched the sunrise, which was rather beautiful. I don't get much opportunities these days to do that, the cloud cover, not up quite so early as a rule, but it was very beautiful to see, and I would, if living in the country, have a greater opportunity, one would hope, depending on where you're situated, of course, in the countryside, either to watch the sunrise or indeed the sunset. Both would be ideal. Anyway, I did that and then had a glass of milk, raw milk, of course, and I've just been meditating in the garden. There was a bit of a wind, a little breeze, that whilst it's perfectly okay to sit on the windowsill and sort of just do a bit of cogitation or awareness sitting as one slowly wakes up. I was much better to do my meditation. I wanted to do it outdoors because of the lovely fresh air, clean air, as clean as it can be, less polluted than in the daytime, of course. And I was sitting in the garden. It's only a yard, there's not much space, but there's an area there where it was out of the wind. So although it wasn't in direct sunshine, because there's no sunshine that comes into that part of the garden, it was bright, and I could see on the face of the back of the house the orange of the sun hit that. So that was sufficient, but I had my eyes closed anyway as I was contemplating, or meditating, I should say. I have a cup of coffee here already made to save that hassle at the beginning of these episodes. And I'm now in the front room sitting on my sofa. The cat, who is normally up and about and begging to go outside, I notice, is sitting on my armchair, the little armchair that I often record the videos on. And he is fast asleep, contentedly fast asleep, so I don't want to disturb him for the moment. He will no doubt rise anyway at some point. He usually does, but perhaps it's still a bit early for him. And I'm having a cup of coffee, which is my want. But I am trying as much as possible to have the first drink of the day, a glass of milk, raw milk, as I said. I've finished reading the other day, actually, this book by Marion Lindsay Noble called Butterfly Moments. And it is the autobiography, not auto, it is a biography of R.F. Delderfield. Ronnie Frederick, I think, Delderfield. And fascinating man who had a passion for writing very early on, and his whole life he wrote loads. Loved Devon, didn't really like leaving Devon, moved around within the county a lot, and must have had a number of rented places because they seemed to move within a matter of weeks, you know, which is I guess you must be when you rent rather than when you buy. And he He didn't really have a lot of money until later on. They managed to survive, his wife May and him. She had, I think, 2 stillbirthed children, which was very sad, and an adopted child, I think, and I think one of their own. I can't remember now exactly the full details. And because I was more interested, of course, in the writing. The fascinating thing that I found that he wrote towards the end, when he was writing God is an Englishman, 6 hours a day, 7 days a week. That's a huge commitment, isn't it? I mean, 5 days a week would be quite prolific, I would think, if you're writing 6 hours. And he was churning out, he said, about 5,000 words a day. Now, yesterday, I spent quite a bit of time writing some scenes which were not terribly complicated as such, but they were had to be thought through as I was writing, and they're not finished. They're not finished is probably the best way to describe it. They've got to be back and smoothed out and, you know, edited and various things. And the one piece was that I wrote was 3,000. Was it 2,800? I think it was 2,800, nearly 3,000 words. And the other one probably that I worked on in the evening was probably no more than 500 words, but it was a complicated thing. Well, not complicated, it was an extension of something. Anyway, it doesn't matter what it was. So I wrote probably about just over 3,000 words yesterday, which if you are just writing simple words, that's one thing, but when you're constructing a story and are trying to be descriptive in an interesting and entertaining fashion, it takes time to think about it. We broke it up by going out for a walk down to the seafront with Julia and Joe. But that was me sitting in front of a screen. I don't know that one could do it now, sitting at a typewriter, as he Delafield, did, and writers of that era, and, you know, before that, I suppose people would just had pen and ink. We're too used to tapping at the screen and having instant feedback and being able to edit and change and all of that, which means that we can, I don't know, but does that mean that we spend too much time trying to get the words correct first time, or... and then coming back to it. And I don't know whether that is I'm trying to sort of work out, would it be better to type it out on a typewriter in which you're not looking at an electronic screen and have it double-spaced, type it all out onto sheets, reams of paper, and then pick up those reams of paper and edit them in pen and ink afterwards, and then hand it to somebody who will type it up for you. You wouldn't want to type it all up again. Well, certainly not me, because it wouldn't be very good at it. And that person may or may not wish to enter it into a computer. And that's the thing, isn't it? Because the first draft is just splurging it out. The second draft, perhaps, is trying to piece it together again and cut out the stuff, the dross that you realise is dross. And I guess a third edit is then really targeting the sentences more specifically. And perhaps that is that you type it out, you correct it and edit it on paper, and then you type it up, correcting and making sure it's good. It's a long process, isn't it? If you're having to do it yourself. But now, the interesting thing that I wanted to get to was the fact that Delafield said that as he got his books were being published, he had an editor, of course, and he would just send the text, send the papers, you know, bundle of chapters and what have you, to the editor to edit as he wrote. So he said, you know, I write like the blazes, and leave it to Richard Hennison or whatever the guy's name was to edit. And I thought, what a brilliant way of doing it. If you're just the originator of the idea and you're successful and you want to get out these books, as indeed I do, to have somebody who will effectively take your, I guess, your first or perhaps your second draft, and then type it all up and edit the final part, that would be the perfect way of working. And he said it is, you know, a writer with a publisher is a collaborative. They're trying to do the best they can because obviously they want to profit from it. They want as many people to buy the books. That's why they're in the business. They love books. They love stories. They love their authors for what they can create. And it's a team effort that the originator writes the first draft, but people who have got those additional skills of grammar but perhaps not the ability to be creative in their writing would shape it, and then it is sold and you both share the profits. And I suppose in some ways I'd never really thought about it that way. I thought about a publisher as really as somebody who was a bit of a parasite. They'd have the marketing ability, and that was kind of it, really. They paid the author to do something, and then they would market it and keep most of the money. So I don't know quite how it operates these days. The ability to self-publish is great, but the main area is, I suppose, that most authors are not very good at marketing, and they want to write. And what was the other thing I was going to say? They often are not very good with money. They might be, of course. I'm not saying they're not. I'm not saying these are hard and fast rules. They may be good with money. But you've got to have quite a lot of disciplines. And if you're just able to concentrate on the creativity and write, and the ancillary stuff can be done by somebody who's good at that, then you've got the perfect working relationship, I suppose. And if you're self-publishing, as I've found, you're bogged down with everything else. So maybe that's something to talk about. I mean, in the show, it's not really what they're interested in, but I could talk about my book for the sake of an episode, and that could be one thing. Because if there are people out there who do publish, perhaps, and they do love books and they want to get these things out, and you know, it would be good. But we'll see. Anyway, it's all just me thinking aloud, isn't it? I'm enjoying the coffee. So, I had a chap on the show the other day. Let me turn this light on. And his name's Mark Plain. He runs a Telegram channel called Not on the Beeb. And he's written a couple of books in the past, but this is a diversion from the normal books that he writes. And he sent me a book here. I was just looking to see if it was signed, but it wasn't signed. Just came in the post. I think he just ordered it from Amazon. Did Amazon print it? I don't know who printed it, actually. Normally it says in the back who printed it. I'm just going to have a look here to see who published it. doesn't really say, and doesn't have a proper frontispiece, doesn't have a proper... That's interesting. He has published them before, but I think he's published them with proper publishers. This one, I think he's done himself, and unless it's at the back. Let's have a look. Maybe it is at the back. He did send me the PDF. No. This is, after reading this book, you'll never look at a taxi in the same way again. Don't know what that means. Anyway, it's called AI and I, What If? Dismantling the Narrative. And he has a conversation with AI. And what it says on the back here is, it's the ultimate wake-up call, reveals connections between electromagnetic frequencies, graphene oxide, unexplained health symptoms through Mark Plain's probing conversations with artificial intelligence. The book uncovers how technology might be affecting human biology in ways deliberately kept hidden from public awareness. And then there's some quotes, I couldn't put it down, gripping and astonishing. My criticism of this, well, firstly, you can't put quotes on the back without attributing them to somebody. Saying, I couldn't put it down, with no attribution to anybody, is pretty meaningless, because who said it? You can't ask that person, what do you mean? Was it glued to your hand physically, or were you absorbed in reading it? Gripping and astonishing, two other quotes. No attribution. If somebody would normally do that on a book, would say, you know, a publisher might be, the Daily Mail said, blah, 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 whatever. But just putting these words on it, that's, to me, is a bit of a strange thing to do. And the other criticism is, it's a conversation with AI. Now, it does seem to me as if people are dealing with AI, as if AI is God, as if it has some omnipotence, omnipresence, or universal knowledge, rather than a calculated machine that scrapes the internet of all the knowledge that's out there. And when I say knowledge, I shouldn't say that. I should say printed information, whether it's accurate, true, opinion, or whatever, and collates it together very rapidly into a conversational style response. But that doesn't make it necessarily true. And as he, and I've read bits of this book in the past when he sent me the PDF, and he probes and probes, and he continually gets, I suppose, different answers, which gives the impression that he is interrogating AI as if it were a human that was revealing more and more. But perhaps what's going on is that he is probing AI, and AI is just going off scraping different bits of information that is, you know, a bit like a fruit machine that you say, you've given me a fruit, a dollar sign, and whatever else they have on there, you know, a chicken. And I'm going to probe again. You pull the one arm on the bandit thing, and it gives you now two pieces of fruit. It's a fruit machine, isn't it? An orange, a blackberry, and something else, a banana. And you do it again, and you get two bananas this time. And so what you're getting is perhaps the internet just chucking up more information, but different. But what you don't get, and this is what worries me, is people are taking it almost as if it must be right, again, because they're falling into the trap, it seems to me, of just because it comes up in black and white in a sentence, which is very clever to do, they take it as it must be true, or at least it's thought about what the information is, rather than scraping up the stuff in variations in various forms. But where are the references? Again, AI is not giving you any references. So you come back to this same problem: if I couldn't put it down, attributed to whom? Whom couldn't put it down? And did they really say that? And if they didn't say, who said that? Because that could just be made up. You can't check that. And that, to me, is where you have a problem right from the start, because how do you know? So let me just at random, because we'll finish off, because I've been going on a little bit here, but I'll just open it up to give you a flavour. This is a chapter 37. And so his name's Mark Plain, and he's got MP. Now, he's a very nice bloke, Mark Plain. I've spoken to him. I've got no animosity to him. I just don't know that I fully get what he's... Blimey, this book is full of pictures, actually, of the sun. Anyway, this, funny enough, it's on about solar events here. Pandemics match solar events. What do you think of this study matching pandemics to years of solar maximum? AI returns. The study by Tapping, Mathias and Serkin presents an interesting correlation between influenza pandemics and solar maximum periods. Okay, so now it is talking about a particular study. So that's good. After reviewing the document, here are my thoughts. Now, are they really thoughts? Or are they just salient points? The research appears, it says, to have identified a statistically significant relationship between influenza pandemics and periods of solar maximum activity. Their stimulation suggests that a 2% probability that this association occurred by random chance, which is noteworthy. Is it noteworthy? I mean, if the computer cannot think, and it is regurgitating salient points in a computive way, then how has it got an opinion to say that is noteworthy? That's an opinion of which a computer... Can a computer have an opinion? Their methodology seems reasonable. Again, that's an opinion. They normalised solar cycles, which actually vary from 10 to 13 years, to compare pandemic timing relative to solar maximum minimum phases, and used two independent pandemic lists, Garrett and Potter, for verification. The key finding is that the pandemic appears more likely to occur around solar maximum periods, with a clear clustering in their phase offset analysis. Table 1 in the documentation shows various pandemics occurring. Anyway, so you have to sit there and read it. You might want to. I don't know what to make of it, really, because I have this... I can hear my alarm going off upstairs. I better go and turn that off and say arrivederci to you guys. But it's interesting, you know, you can pull up a research paper, which is great, and you can source it, which is great, but have you done any more than pull up the search paper and said, here is the salient points from this research paper? That I have, you know, the time-saving aspect. The time-saving aspect of that, I think, is brilliant. So from that point of view, the computation that it can go... You can ask it something, say, would you please find information relating to, and then it will spew it up, a bit like a search engine. And then can you give me the salient points? Could you put that into a synopsis? I think that's very good. I haven't used it, I haven't done that myself, but people do, I think a lot of people do that, and that's all very good. I have no problem with that as such. That's a useful technology to have, provided you can continually reference the sources. You know, when you say, could you find everything about candle making or the dissecting of an ant or, you know, the knitting of a something, a jumper, please can you list the places you found this information and where you're getting it all from? That would be what I would want to do. Just putting away some clothes that were left out last night. But the bit where you're starting to get it to, let's say, reveal something in a way that is an opinion piece and you don't know the sources, this is where I start to part company with the ability, because I think some people have got it into their heads that this, what they call artificial intelligence, is able to actually think, is sentient. Now, the word intelligent gives the impression, and perhaps ought to, and should, and perhaps does, mean that something is sentient, able to think for themselves and form opinions, have inspiration, have some sense of awareness that it is in fact alive and more than just a regurgitating machine that can access billions of facts very quickly and put them into a sentence that synopsizes what it's just found. But I don't think that AI, that the word intelligence is a correct description for it, and I think that's a bit of a misnomer personally, because I don't believe being a, I don't believe that computers, anything that computes, can, or certainly in an electronic form, can have that sentient, the same sentient, am I getting that word right? I may not be, sentient, is it? Sentient, not sentient, sentient. That, can it have a consciousness that makes it alive, that makes it alive to think in the way that you and I think? I don't believe so. And while there'll be sci-fi movies to give that impression, to scare people and worry people that AI is going to take over, I think it potentially has huge powers to take over people's jobs in some respect, repetitive jobs and other things. However, things that need inspiration, creativity, in a way that is less obvious than AI is doing at the moment, even though it can produce quick pictures and things and all of that. I'm losing my thread now, I think, because I've just looked out the window and watched a bloke looking at his van. I think that the AI, there's an AI fear-mongering that it is going to take over the world. And whilst there'll be some sense that it will take over people's jobs, I get that, but I don't think that it can in any way take over the human mind. The old adage is that the created can never be better or higher or control the creator. And I think that's still true. Anyway, thank you for watching, listening even. And sorry, I'm pausing there because the cat is peering at something. It's sitting on the sofa, it stood up and it's just peering very intently at something on the sofa. Maybe it's a flea. Anyway, I shall flee now. Take care, and I will talk to you tomorrow. Bye for now.